This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, Don't Mourn, Organize, the loss and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. with Dr. Claiborne Carson and Dr. Vincent Harding. But first, an excerpt from King's 1967 speech, The Other America.
There are literally two Americas. One America is overflowing with the milk of prosperity and the honey of opportunity. This America is the habitat of millions of people who have food and material necessities for their bodies, and culture and education for their minds. In this America, millions of people experience every day the opportunity of having life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in all of their dimensions. And in this America, millions of young people grow up in the sunlight of opportunity. But tragically and unfortunately, there is another America. And this other America has a daily ugliness about it that constantly transforms the buoyancy of hope into the fatigue of despair. In this America, millions of work-starved men walk the streets daily in search for jobs that do not exist. In this America, millions of people find themselves living in rat-infested, vermin-filled slums. People are poor by the millions, and they find themselves perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. Little children in this other America are forced to grow up with clouds of inferiority forming every day in their little mental sky. This other America, we see it as an arena of blasted hopes and shattered dreams. Many people of various backgrounds live in this other America. Some are Mexican Americans, some are Puerto Ricans, some are Indians. Millions of them are Appalachian white. Probably the largest group in this other America, in proportion to its size in the population, is the American Negro. The American Negro finds himself living in a triple ghetto, a ghetto of race, a ghetto of poverty, a ghetto of human misery. And so what we are seeking to do in the civil rights movement is to deal with this problem of the two Americas. We are seeking to make America one nation. The struggle for civil rights, or the struggle to make these two Americas one America, is much more difficult today than it was 5 or 10 years ago. We struggled all across the South to get rid of legal, overt segregation. In a sense, this was a struggle for decency. We could not go to a lunch counter in so many instances and get a hamburger or a cup of coffee. We did not have the right to vote in so many areas of the South. And by the thousands, we protested these conditions. Many things were gained as a result of these years of struggle. The Civil Rights Bill came into being. We were able to get a voting rights bill. Now, all of these things represented strides. But we must see that the struggle today is much more difficult. It's more difficult today because we are struggling now for genuine equality. And it's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee a livable income and a good, solid job. It's much easier to guarantee the right to vote than it is to guarantee the right to live in sanitary, decent housing conditions. It is much easier to integrate a public park than it is to make genuine, quality, integrated education a reality. And so today, we are struggling for something which says we demand genuine equality. And I'm convinced that many of the very people who supported us in the struggle in the South are not willing to go all the way now. And I came to see that so many people who supported morally and even financially what we were doing in Birmingham and Selma were really outraged against the extremist behavior of Bull Connor and Jim Clark toward Negroes, rather than believing in genuine equality for Negroes. This is what makes the struggle much more difficult.
You were listening to a fragment of a speech delivered by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on April 14, 1967, The Other America. The speech was made against the background of urban rebellions, pleas for black power, and the Vietnam War. The speech was masterful and riveting, expounding on the threats of militarism, racism, and economic degradation and wealth disparity, the promise of America, and the reality of its duality based on race and class.
Dr. Claiborne Carson and Dr. Vincent Harding join us to discuss the loss and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on this commemoration of his assassination. Dr. Carson is professor of history at Stanford University and director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute. Since 1985, he has directed the Martin Luther King Papers Project, a long-term project to edit and publish the papers of Martin Luther King Jr.
And Dr. Vincent Harding is a historian, a scholar of religion and society, an activist as well. He is best known for his work with Dr. King and his writings about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Harding also is known for drafting King's 1967 anti-Vietnam War speech delivered at the Riverside Church. Well, suffice it to say that these are contemporaries of Dr. King and extremely theoretical and activist individuals who are going to help us understand somebody who, again, I think was one of the most profound statespersons. Every time I think about a birthday or the assassination date of Dr. King and I match it against the time that we're living in, I say, aha, he had something to say. It was relevant. It was prophetic. It resounds today. And it always is. Race, class, militarism, materialism. But somebody who can say it so much better than I are Dr. Vincent Harding and Dr. Claiborne. And why don't we begin with, if we can, the fragment that we heard from the speech in 1967, The Other America, which is somewhat less known and certainly less played than either the Riverside speech or the Mountaintop speech. What is the resonance of that speech today?
One of the things that I would say, just to start out, and I would like to see what Vincent thinks about this, is that when we were putting together Volume 6 of the King Papers, which has to do with his religious development, I came across this document in 1948 where Martin Luther King laid out his mission as a minister. And he said that his mission was to deal with slums, unemployment, economic insecurity. And he didn't even mention civil rights. And I think of that when we look at the trajectory of his life from 48 to 68. At the end of his life, that's basically what he was doing. He was focusing on his mission as a social gospel minister. He wasn't doing that role of being the civil rights leader. So one way of looking at his life, which might be a bit simplistic, is to say that Rosa Parks put him on a detour, that he started out to be this social gospel minister. He happened to be in Montgomery in 1955. So for the next 10 years, he was drafted into this role of being a civil rights leader. And pretty much with the Voting Rights Act, that role was successful. But he didn't retire and say, I achieved my goal, and now I can get back to being a minister or maybe go on being the dean of religion at some school. He then went to Watts in Chicago and finally Memphis. And so I see him almost getting back to his original mission, and that speech is really comes to me to represent the real Martin Luther King as much as his civil rights speeches.
I think that Clay has touched on something very important, and that is that in our tendency to try to categorize people in chunks that we can manage, we fail to see their fullness and their largeness. And certainly for Martin King, there was a largeness that was represented in that speech segment that we were just listening to. Because what he was focusing on at the outset, without necessarily defining it fully for us, was that his search was ultimately for our nation to really be one nation, one America, he spoke of. And it seems to me that though it was being worked on along racial lines primarily as he entered the Southern movement, there is this wonderful larger question that we can wrestle with now concerning what does one America look like, mean? What does that foretell for us in the 21st century? And I think Martin would be ready to jump into that question, bringing with him, as Clay says, all of his social concerns, which grew deeply out of his sense of what it means to be a pastor, what it means to encourage our best humanity, and what it is to care for people in meeting their deepest needs.
And I think he's also saying in that speech that now we got the easy part done. That is, bringing the South into the rest of the nation. You know, you had this history in the South of being this separate place from the rest of the nation with respect to race relations. But I think he's saying that's easy. You know, that at least compared to, with the deeper question of after we've got the South and the race issue, we've made it national. What have we really accomplished? If we brought African Americans into a nation, how do we govern that nation? How do we, you know, what is our destiny?
Yes, how do we determine where we want to go as a nation and what we want to be as a nation?
Yeah, there is this aspect of trust when we talk about democracy that it's when we walk into a room and someone says, you know, this room is now going to be determining your destiny and we'll do it by a majority vote, that takes a lot of trust. And I think, Vincent, you've talked about this as we need courses on advanced democracy because we've only really experienced democracy or something close to it in the last 50 years.
Yes.
Before 1965, this country was not a democracy. And what we know now is that it's a difficult experiment, and we don't know the outcome of that experiment. But we do know that that experiment is going on in South Africa and Brazil and in Europe and in many nations around the world, where it's easy to have democracy when you know who's in charge, when there's a homogeneous democracy. But that's not the problem for most of the countries in the world. They know now in France that they're not a homogeneous nation. They've got the offspring of people they've colonized in past years. And somehow that means a different kind of democracy. So all nations are really faced with this problem of how do you have diversity and democracy? And that's hard.
And indeed, Dr. Harding, the conjuncture of race and class, and I'm moving maybe from the South to Detroit summer to 1966, the year after Watts exploded, and Dr. King lived off and on in Chicago, where some people refer to it as truly where the grapes of wrath were stored. How does Dr. King's instruction and tutelage, where does that take us today in that continuing clash of race and class within society?
I think that one of the places that it takes us is in the same direction that he was trying to go, trying to clarify for ourselves and create for ourselves the country that has not yet come into being, the country that Langston Hughes was referring to when he said, America, you've never been America to me. And it may be that in 2010, what we realize, as Clay was indicating earlier, that the America that the greatest of our dreamers and workers have envisioned has never been for anybody. And so what our task is now is to move together towards clarifying with each other and for each other what that America is, what it can be, how not just black and white, but all the great multitude of us can bring that into being, but at the same moment, never forgetting what King never forgot, and that is that we are not a nation cut off from the world, that we must also try to figure out what is the meaning of our multiracial democracy as it tries to come into being. What is its meaning for the world that has so often been pressed down by those who claimed to be the leaders of the free world? What now shall we make of our role in a world where we're finally understanding that most of the world is a world of color, a world that has gone through hard, hard times, and a world that still has much too much disparity between the rich and the poor? How do we create an America that can deal in collaboration and cooperation with that world that still is coming into being?
Some things that went through my mind, Vincent,
yes,
as I was watching with everyone else the healthcare debate.
Yes.
And I was thinking of my metaphor of walking into a room and saying that this is a democracy, your destiny is going to be determined by the people in this room, and thinking of the Senate.
Mm.
You know, here is 100 people, and we're expecting them to make a decision that's going to affect not just their destiny, but the destiny of all of us. And they were completely divided. You know, that there was no way they could get together. You have one faction versus another faction. And one of the results of that is that you would wonder whether that 100 people would have been able to come to a decision if that body had reflected the diversity of America, as opposed to being a body of 100 white people. And whether that would have made the decision-making, you can't imagine decision-making being done in a worse way than was done by the Senate. So maybe having a diverse 100 people would have actually improved the decision-making. but we will never know that because it's not very reflective of the diversity of America. And yet we rely on these unrepresentative, undemocratic bodies to make decisions that affect us all. I think that's breaking down.
And that, of course, is where King was trying to, what he was trying to woo us towards, to see that we had better potentials than we had ever begun to realize. And it's only as we gather ourselves, recognize our oneness, and operate out of that oneness that is so rich. I think that that's what Martin, in a sense, felt, deeply felt. He intuited the fact that we have a great capacity to be not financially, but humanely a tremendously rich nation. And as you say, out of that richness, if it is fully utilized, could come magnificent products, including the product of how we help to take care of each other and how we help to bear each other's burdens. I think King would have been all over this late sense of set of discussions as the pastor that he was, caring for the health, the spiritual, physical, mental health of the people.
And is the message of King, especially as enunciated during the last year or two of his life, is this getting out to people in any kind of way? You wrote a book, The Inconvenient Hero, saying that that part of his message was ignored.
Yes, you know, I have a feeling that there is more getting out than we realize. My sense is that our temptation is to feel that so much of the best is not at work anymore. But my experience is that wherever I have been going over these last 15, 20, 30 years, there are people, including some fantastic young people, who are experimenting, who are searching, who realize that King, whether they use him by name or by idea, was pointing to something that we could still be pointing towards in our own version of it, pointing to an America that is yet to be, but can be. So I think that that message of the great possibilities, the great human possibilities of America is out there more than we realize. And those of us who feel it, sense it, are willing to work, are like crazy for it, have to discover each other more and more and more. And with the kind of communications technology that we now have, there's no reason why we can't discover each other and find ways to work with each other, because we are there. It's not that we are absent. We are there, and we have to discover how we can be there with each other.
And in the remaining moment that we have, again, Dr. King died fighting for really a living wage for sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee. What do we say about that, Dr. Carson?
Well, I think that it's imagining him being alive today and what he would be fighting for, what kinds of issues he would bring up. I think that the issues that meant most to him, the issues that were at the heart of his mission as a preacher of the gospel, was this issue of the division between rich and poor, the gulf that still exists and in fact is even more the case today. I think that that's the issue that would concern him, and the fact that we are ignoring that issue, that it doesn't really get discussed very much, would be it shows how much we miss him, because he would be very persistent in reminding us that we haven't done anything to deal with bringing his dream of a truly one people trying to achieve democracy together, that we're farther away from that than we were at the time of his death.
Dr. Claiborne Carson and Dr. Vincent Harding, there's so much to say and to learn from both the loss of and the legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, and from your own personal experiences with Dr. King as well as in your own right. And we are truly honored that both of you are with us.
Well, I am certainly glad for that, too, and I'm glad that you brought in the music of Hubert Laws.
You got it!
And Amazing Grace, because it is still amazing what our possibilities are. And I live on those possibilities for myself, and I'm glad that you're trying to remind us about the possibilities and the opportunities. And Clay, it's wonderful to talk to you again.
Thank you.
And we have been speaking to Dr. Claiborne Carson and Dr. Vincent Harding on this, the assassination commemoration of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. I'm Mimi Rosenberg with Ken Nash. Thank you for listening. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.